1936. A number of other organizations are sponsoring and co-sponsoring this mobilization as well. You are tuned to listener-sponsored, commercial-free community radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. Stay tuned for Health Action coming up next.
World is broken, fragments and pieces. Once we're joined together in a unified whole.
Mayday 2002. Corporate globalization and wars abroad, austerity, unemployment, and mass violations of immigrant rights. Build bridges with us as we talk with sisters and brothers around the world, from Palestine and Italy to Mexico and Colombia, about forming a global labor movement to counter the New World Order. And join our very special guests, Ozzy Davis, Ruby Dee, Harry Belafonte, and farm labor heroine Dolores Huerta. So join Building Bridges, your community and labor report. Report is Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash for a Mayday special. May 1st, 2 to 6 p.m. over listener-supported WBAI. Workers of the world, unite.
We can start all over, create a new world.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health Action. I'm Bob Lederer here in studio with Kathy Davis. And today in our first half, we're going to have a special update that we're calling Marketing Cancer Globally, a report on the dumping of cigarettes in poor countries that was prepared for us by Ginger Otis, the WBAI News Department. And in our second half, we're going to take a departure from the usual topics we cover here on Health Action to deal with a very important issue facing listeners of this radio station and the network that we're part of, the Pacifica Network, and that is the process of democratizing the governance, the process of deciding who controls decision-making throughout the network. And we're going to have a discussion with two listener activists who've been involved in the dialogue that's now going on throughout the five stations about exactly how this network should be governed in a more democratic fashion. So stay tuned for that. But first, we're going to go to some news briefs, and then we'll get into our first segment. Stay tuned. Again, this is Bob Lederer with the Health Action News. Continuing our ongoing update of the dire medical situation in occupied Palestine, we have this summary of the situation since the most recent Israeli invasion of the West Bank on March 29th. And the following information comes from the Palestine Red Crescent Society, which is the local affiliate of the International Committees of the Red Cross. And the Red Crescent Society reports that the total number of Palestinian deaths in the West Bank and Gaza since March 29th, when the invasion began, is 262, with 586 injuries. And there's a note saying that the figures are likely underestimates due to the inability of the Red Crescent personnel to get access to many areas. And the summary continues that ambulances continue to have no access to villages surrounding major towns. The Israeli army continues its redeployment to encircle the cities of Ramallah and Nablus. Several Ramallah neighborhoods continue to remain under occupation and curfew. And Bethlehem remains a restricted military area with complete siege and curfew imposed. Four ambulance team members from the Palestine Red Crescent Society continue to be detained by the Israeli army. And the Red Crescent Society and International Committees of the Red Cross continue to provide relief to people in need throughout the West Bank by providing food, water, and medical supplies despite extreme restrictions on movement and access. As of April 22nd, there had been 39 emergency medical personnel and other medical staff detained by the Israeli military while they were undertaking rescue operations. The Israeli army has not filed any formal charges in any of these instances. Requests for information from the Israeli army by the International Committees of the Red Cross have largely been ignored. And I should note that in the catalog provided on the website of the Red Crescent Society, it lists what happened to some of these 39 people. And in most cases, the footnote says handcuffed, beaten, and blindfolded. And these are trained medical personnel we're talking about. And the most recent incident was on April 29th, which was just yesterday. Dr. Yunus Zaloum, the deputy president of the Palestine Red Crescent Society branch in Hebron, which many of you may know was the most recent target of Israeli invasion, was arrested and detained by the Israeli army for a few hours and then released. During a routine call, the ambulance was called to transfer two bodies to the hospital. Once they were transferred, the same ambulance then headed for the Red Crescent headquarters, carrying Dr. Zaloum and a visiting team from France. The Israeli army forced the ambulance to stop near the hospital, at which time the ambulance was searched. The medics and Dr. Zaloum were personally searched, their ID cards confiscated. Dr. Zaloum was arrested and transferred to a armored personnel carrier and taken to detention. And finally, 2 days ago, legal proceedings commenced in Israel in which the Palestine Red Crescent Society will be demonstrating Israeli army collusion and plans to plant an explosive device as part of an ongoing disinformation and slander campaign against the Red Crescent Society. Recently released images show that the supposed Israeli army checkpoint was, quote, somehow ready with video cameras to capture the event. So in other words, that as justification for the huge amount of ambulance personnel who are being detained and the number of, I believe it's 80% of the ambulances that have been damaged or destroyed in the past year, has been justified by saying that these ambulances were actually transporting explosives, and this is going to be shown in court to be a lie. So that's just some of the latest news from the occupied territories. As far as medical workers. Now, one other news story here on the home front. This comes from Newsday, Sunday, April 28th. Headline, World Trade Center Minority Workers' Ills Persist. More than 400 immigrant workers hired to clean buildings near the World Trade Center site continued to suffer respiratory and other symptoms months after their first exposure to the dust, a Queens College physician reported yesterday. The mobile health, a mobile health unit had been set up near Ground Zero as a joint project of Queens College, the New York Committee for Occupational Safety and Health, the Latin American Workers Project, and others. It was established for immigrant workers and day laborers hired to clean office buildings in the area after the September 11th attack. From January to March, the van's medical staff offered free medical exams, including breathing tests, collection of blood and urine and interviews. In late February, nearly all the workers still had health symptoms which had either appeared or worsened after September 11th. According to Dr. Steve Markowitz, the project's director, quote, one of the most striking findings is the persistence in symptoms even after they stopped work and were no longer exposed to dust. Many had stopped working near Ground Zero 2 months earlier, and when they came to the van, they still had symptoms. Generally, Dr. Markowitz said, most recover quickly after such acute occupational exposures, and those with persistent symptoms usually are few in number. That usual pattern did not happen in this case, Markowitz said. Of the 415 people examined, almost all were Latino immigrants, mainly from Colombia and Ecuador. Virtually none of the workers have health insurance or a personal physician. And so that's an ongoing story that we're monitoring here at Health Action. And there will be a major conference called Beyond September 11th, Environmental and Public Health Policy, that will occur on Thursday, May 9th, all day, 8:30 to 5 p.m. at the CUNY Graduate Center on 5th Avenue between 34th and 35th Street in Manhattan. And for more information, contact the New York Committee on Occupational Safety and Health at 212-627-3900. Again, that's 212-627-3900, or go on the web at NYCOSH, that's NYCOSH.org. Okay, and that is it for the news headlines, and we're going to go into our first segment in just a minute. Stay tuned. Back on Health Action. This is Bob Lederer with Kathy Davis. And today, Health Action is going to take a look at the global grassroots effort to impose some kind of control on multinational tobacco companies. Worldwide, approximately 4 million people die from tobacco-related illnesses each year. This is the equivalent of 27 747 airplanes full of passengers crashing every day. And the number of smoking-related deaths is expected to reach 10 million by the year 2030, and approximately 80% of those deaths will occur in developing countries. But there's an international movement afoot to stop big tobacco in its tracks. Grassroots activists throughout Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia, and Eastern Europe have begun a multi-layered anti-smoking campaign. The groups collaborate on ways to improve public awareness about the risks involved with smoking, limit the ways in which multinational tobacco companies can advertise their products, and perhaps most importantly, rewrite or create laws so public health is favored over the concept of so-called free trade. Ginger Otis from the WBAI News Department attended a conference held in New York City last week that featured several key activists in the worldwide anti-smoking campaign, and she brings us this report.
Last week in New York's Rockefeller Center, a network of public health advocates from around the world sat down for a two-hour discussion on the global tobacco epidemic. The seminar is part of a nationwide tour coordinated by the U.S.-based organization Tobacco Free Kids. Activists will be visiting almost every major U.S. city for the next 2 weeks in an attempt to get their message out to the public. One of the participants is Dr. Eva Kralikova, an assistant professor in the Faculty of Medicine in the Czech Republic and head of the Smoking Cessation Clinic. I attended last week's event and spoke with Dr. Kralikova about the importance of her work. I wanted to talk about the misperception that a lot of Americans have that smoking and the global attempts to induce smoking among people is simply a matter of free choice. That's a perception that we have here, but we also have
many years of strong anti-smoking legislation and advocacy under our belts. And I believe this kind of a struggle is viewed much more as a human rights issue overseas. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. You are absolutely right. It's misused by tobacco industry, this issue of human rights and about speaking about free choice. And so, for example, at the shareholders meeting of Philip Morris, I was impressed how they present themselves, and they behave completely otherwise in my country. So this is really, really big difference. And they would never do the same thing in U.S., what they are doing in our countries. For example, Geoffrey Bible spoke about his thinking that in Europe we have democratic governments being able to decide what they want and want not. But there is very, very strong influence by tobacco industry to our members of parliament and to our politicians.
And there was recently a report released that Philip Morris had commissioned, and it didn't initially send shockwaves through the Czech Republic, but once the U.S. media got hold of it, there was kind of a belated response. Can you tell us what the report found that Philip Morris commissioned?
Yes. Firstly, about this report itself, and secondly, about the perception of our journalists, which you just mentioned. Czech journalists did not pay any attention to it before. It was interesting for U.S. media. So this is one big difference. And about this report itself, it was distributed to our members of parliament. It was a report about the economic impact of tobacco or of smoking on the Czech economy. And Philip Morris hired an economic consultant agency, Arthur DeLittle, and they sent a nice report to our members of parliament saying that early dying from smoking means economic benefit to the government, because you save pensions and you save money for housing for elderly. And so really it was very bad thing. And except of they apologized after it has been published in U.S., our members of parliament still believe probably that this report was right. And it was successful because our government, shortly after they got this report, our government asked European Union for delay in increasing tobacco taxes and so tobacco prices after Czech Republic would join European Union. So one of about five exceptions we would have after being member of European Union, unfortunately, will be delay in tobacco tax increase.
Explain to us a little bit about the power that Philip Morris has in your country. If many Americans are unaware of the impunity that goes on overseas and how deeply embedded the governmental system of many developing countries is with the wishes of big tobacco and multinational tobacco companies.
Yes, they have very strong influence, but you know, it's hardly to describe because it's not open, but you can imagine what for work is behind. If I tell you that in Czech language the word America with small a and k instead of c, the word America means a good cigarette. So they influence our politicians. They try to buy credibility by sponsoring some events and giving money to some really needed actions. For example, here in America, they presented, at the shareholders meeting, Philip Morris presented one of their programs for smoking prevention among children. One of them was done in Czech Republic, and there was displayed a poster from the Czech Republic. But this was such a small and such an ineffective campaign compared to the same time very much aggressive marketing of tobacco products to our children, that nobody in Czech Republic would believe that you mean seriously that this program was about the prevention of smoking among children. So Philip Morris tries to be very credible, very nice company in our country.
Epidemic of smoking that appeared in the United States, particularly among men in the 1950s, has peaked just recently, and the rate of death among men has somewhat fallen off, and it's actually now on the upswing for women in the United States. So there's a lag time between when smoking reaches epidemic proportions in a country and then before you see the actual results of that, the actual people dying. How is the situation in the Czech Republic, and do you have any stats on how many people die a year from smoking-related illnesses?
We have about every fifth death in Czech Republic is caused by tobacco. And the epidemic is moving, the tobacco epidemic is moving around the world exactly same ways. So in each society, first men start to smoke about 40 years after the peak of prevalence of smoking among men. The mortality from smoking reaches the top. And after this happens, people start slowly, hopefully, to understand what tobacco means. And this is, well, in United States, you were the first who started smoking. You also started as first to die because of it. But also you started as first in the world to understand what tobacco means, the health impact of tobacco. So you have best research concerning tobacco and health, and this is very important to spread this knowledge to other parts of the world. It's the social acceptance of smoking in each society which is plays the key role.
Dr. Eva Kralikova is an assistant professor in the Faculty of Medicine at Czech University in the Czech Republic and head of the Smoking Cessation Clinic in Prague. She has spent more than a decade fighting the tobacco industry's encroachment into her country and has authored more than 100 papers on smoking addiction. Another attendee at last week's event was Mary Asunta, a member of the Consumers Association of Penang in Malaysia, where she coordinates national action against the tobacco industry. She is currently on a one-year sabbatical at the University of Sydney in Australia, researching tobacco industry documents and pursuing a master's in public health. She also granted WBAI an interview. The United States has had a long-term and an instrumental role in creating the flood of multinational, mostly American-based cigarette companies into Asian countries. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
In the mid-1980s, the U.S. government, through the Trade Representative's Office, was responsible for pricing open the markets of at least four countries in Asia. And this would be Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, and Thailand. To give an example of what happened, in 1998, for example, when South Korea was forced to open its markets to American cigarettes, smoking rate for young boys jumped from 18% to 30%, and for young girls, which was only at 2%, then jumped to about 9%. And this happened just within a year. So the reason why there was such a significant increase among smoking among young people is that when the American cigarettes entered the market, the American tobacco multinationals bring with it a very sophisticated and very aggressive, very glitzy type of advertising to promote the American brands. And this certainly was also the case with the other markets like Japan and Thailand. So in that sense, the incidence of smoking went up quite significantly in these countries.
Where does the World Trade Organization, or WTO, fit into this picture? Does it do anything to encourage or limit the global cigarette business?
I think one needs to remember, as far as WTO or any trade treaty goes, the basis of such trade treaty is to encourage free trade, you know, among countries. So foremost on the table is that trade flourishes among countries. As long as you have tobacco as a hazardous product, as an item in that trade, basically what you're doing is you're encouraging a tobacco business to flourish. And I think that this is where the difficulty is, and that we are trying to discourage the tobacco trade. You know, it's because it is a public health disaster. Tobacco is a product that is responsible for a public health epidemic, and we want to address this. Therefore, in fact, cigarettes should be removed as an item, you know, on the free trade agenda.
Isn't there some kind of a rule that says within the World Trade Organization that if a product is harmful to a person's health, there are restrictions imposed upon it?
This is certainly true for WTO, that it is an exception clause. It applies to public health, and it applies right across the board, both for local cigarettes as well as for imported. However, what is difficult about applying or for countries to use this clause is that the burden of proof applies to the country. A country, for example, that wants to stop, say, imported cigarettes from coming in would then have to provide the evidence and the proof, which means that country will have to make a case. And this is quite hard for countries to do, and that's why this clause is not being effectively utilized by countries. So yes, in principle, an exception clause exists. However, countries are not utilizing it effectively simply because it is hard. I think under the tobacco treaty that is being negotiated in Geneva right now, called the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, what the Asian countries and particularly developing countries in Asia are asking for is that public health be put above trade. Here it is much clearer in that the principle of the matter is there already is so much evidence and science available on smoking and on the harms caused by tobacco use. Hence, if this clause is adopted in principle, then the burden of proof would no longer be on the country that wants to impose public health measures at the expense of trade. And I think that this is very significant.
Let's paint a picture out there for people who aren't really understanding, perhaps aren't grasping the enormity of what's going on. When you think of developing nations and all the people that live there and the number of men that already are addicted to smoking, the enormous number of women and children that are now being targeted and bombarded, and the very frail health system, if there's any, that exists in most of these countries. Where does this actually take us if the onslaught of advertising and multinational impunity is not checked immediately?
The developing world certainly has a huge public health disaster on our hands. And therefore, we need to check the spread of this epidemic very quickly. There are a couple of things that we need to do, and we have to do it fast. One of which is, of course, advertising and marketing of cigarettes. Developing countries today are calling for a total ban on all forms of advertising and marketing, and also to increase taxes so that cigarettes become expensive and they are beyond the reach of poor people and children. So these are some of the measures, you know, that need to be put in place immediately. But I would like to say that the United States today must be promoting public health internationally, simply because the U.S. is home to the world's largest tobacco transnational, and hence it should not be promoting a product, but it should be championing a public health internationally, and that it should be seen to do so.
What tactics are you using to bring this issue to the public attention?
Well, we have been speaking with the public health community of universities, you know, researchers, students who are involved in public health, because while they engage in research, this research has to be translated into policies. But we're also making an appeal to legislators, to Congress, men and women, to senators, with the hope that the policy change that the people in the U.S. are putting in place here must have an international component, that the domestic legislation, the domestic policies must be reflected internationally, that these policies don't only take care of American citizens, but that it also takes care of the problem internationally. So my appeal is really to the legislators and also to the general American public, who I think generally seem to be unaware of what the American companies are doing internationally. So to raise a level of awareness among the general public, so that the American public can demand for accountability from both the government as well as from the tobacco transnational.
Mary Asunta is a member of the Consumers Association of Penang in Malaysia. She, along with Dr. Kralikova and many other health advocates, will convene in Geneva this October for the sixth preparatory meeting on the World Health Organization's International Framework on Tobacco Control. Activists from more than 190 countries will participate in the creation of an internationally binding document that could effectively curb big tobacco impunity. The United States has not yet announced if it will send a delegation. For Health Action Network, I'm Ginger Otis.
And thank you, Ginger Otis from the WBAN News Department, for doing that special report for Health Action. And when we come back from our music break, we will return with our second segment about democratization of the Pacifica Radio Network. Stay tuned.
One, two. I just came over here to London to cool out with my man Jazzy V and the Soul and Soul Posse. I go by the name of Fab Five Freddy. I got something I want to say. Check it out. Lay your cards on the table. Place your bet. I'll lay your odds. This is something that you haven't heard yet. It's fine to find like a vintage wine. Best of all, yes, sure. It's genuine. It's the sound of Soul and Soul.
Our time is done to be together and live as one. Forever living free. Happily, your time is come, yeah.
Take my time to create the strife. Weather the situation drew me time after time. I was flowing, going on and on. Inducing motivation, though it made me strong. So, clearing my mind of intentions and thoughts. Like the one that brought us here. Here to this place. So now you gotta gain your own time and space by moving in the right direction. H5, a selection of action. Enriching positivity. No time for negativity. It's prospering, developing, and we're enveloping. And I'm here showing you all something flowing, going on and on. Our time is now, come, our time is now, come.
WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. This is Health Action, co-hosted by myself, Kathy Davis, and Bob Lederer. And today we brought you a very important segment on how, once again, the corporations of this company, of this country, are moving into communities of color and affecting them in a negative way. And it gave some insight on what we might be able to do about that. On Health Action, we make an attempt to bring you information on your own individual health and the health of our communities. In our next segment, we're going to be talking about the health of Pacifica and WBAI itself. And we will be sharing information with you about the ongoing debate on the Pacifica bylaws.
That's right, Kathy. Again, this is Bob Lederer, and as many of our listeners may know, the past year and a half or so has convulsed this radio station in a struggle against a group that had actually infiltrated and gradually taken control of the top levels of management of this non-commercial, listener-supported progressive network over roughly the past 10 years or so, and had managed one by one to take down the five stations. The content that they had previously been prized for had become world-renowned as purveyors of alternative information, of political coverage that challenged the powers that be, of cutting-edge cultural presentations from artists not usually heard on the mainstream and corporate media. That was all being radically changed by a group of people who in many ways had connections that led right back to the centrist wing of the Democratic Party, and were very tied into the fact that 10% of the network's funding has been coming for the past 20 years from a congressionally funded organization called the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And those top officials had developed an alliance with top officials of Pacifica to try to de-radicalize a lot of the programming, and particularly and most relevant to today's discussion, that took the form that varied in each city, but in the cities of Los Angeles and Houston, it took the form of a direct attack on programming by and about people of color from a progressive, working class, and anti-capitalist kind of perspective. And so one by one, programmers were purged. And of course, many of you may know, Kathy and I were among the 30 programmers who were purged here at WBAI because we stood up against this mainstreaming juggernaut by the powers that be. Now, the question we're discussing today is how can we build a new, how can we be part of building a new governance structure for this network so that that doesn't happen again? And that speaks to the question of what we have currently, which is a structure that was started more than 50 years ago by the progressive pacifists who founded Pacifica, first in Berkeley and later in four other stations, which was essentially a benevolent, I wouldn't say a dictatorship, but a benevolent association of like-minded people who chose a board of directors nationally, and then as each station came online, a local advisory board of progressive-minded people picked by the preceding board, a self-selected series of boards. And what we're converting to now, under the pressure of the massive uprising by mainly listeners and a few producers using tools such as lawsuits, boycotts, demonstrations, speakouts, and many other formats, we now have a mandate, which I think everyone supports, to institute democratic elected local boards by the end of this year, which will in turn elect a new national board to replace the interim board that we have now of very progressive people who are among the leaders of the struggle, that are kind of the caretakers and the people shepherding this process of grassroots involvement in rewriting the bylaws. So that's where we're at today, and we have two longtime listener activists with us to bring up to address the particular question. We only have about 20 minutes, so it's a very complex set of issues, and we're going to zero in on one in particular that's hotly being debated at weekly open meetings that everyone in the listening public is invited to about the way the bylaw should be rewritten. And that specific debate for today we're going to focus on is how to define who will have the right to vote in these elections at the end of this year to choose a local board that many people are saying will become more than an advisory board, may actually, although this hasn't been decided yet, but it could become the board that actually has much more direct supervision and governance power over WBAI, not simply to elect two people as part of a national board, but to directly hire a general manager and to supervise or have at least broad overview of programming. So, let me bring our first guest up. We are joined on the phone by Anthony McCall, who is the founder and executive director of the SEEDS organization, which works to sustain economic development in African and African-American communities here in New York. And he's also a member of the WBAI Local Advisory Board and a stalwart in last year's struggle to reverse the coup here at this station and throughout the network. Anthony, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Bob, for having me. Hi, Cass.
Hi, Anthony.
Okay, so why don't you start by laying out, as you see it, the issues involved in this difficult decision about who should be able to vote in these elections for the local board and how to make the local board, which currently, although it has been self-appointed by the preceding board and the one before that and the one before that, has actually been remarkably diverse, not only racially but ideologically and in terms of different progressive concerns of many listeners. How can that be maintained in a future board? Because I know that's a preoccupation of you and many people in the community, and particularly given the historic patterns of the predominantly white progressive movement that seems to find a unique way of replicating white domination of every institution. This is a board that's majority people of color, progressive people of color, unlike the old national board that we overthrew 4 months ago that was majority people of color who were not progressive. So what are some of the issues you see in how to sustain that kind of a spirit and a breadth and a diversity on the board while really instituting genuine democracy?
Well, let me just first say that I think the challenge is both one of understanding philosophically what's in play and also how there can be a practical translation of whatever any of us really feel philosophically. Primarily, there's a need, it seems, for all of us who are involved in the active effort to figure out what democratization means in the context of Pacifica and WBAI and how it specifically relates to governance, developing a revised set of bylaws, and elections, that we try to overlay that with what we feel is our mission as far as outreach is concerned. To me, we are trying to reach out to a number of constituent communities, a number of groups that are largely underrepresented, communities of color, for example, communities that involve those who are physically challenged, those who are young, a number of different groups, people who are in prison and are unable to participate actively but can listen on the radio and do some support work. There are a number of communities such as that. The lesbian gay community is another community that's often been challenged and under attack. So by way of examples, those kinds of communities are among those that we are primarily focused on having a more involved role for. Inclusion, I think, is a key consideration there. In that respect, what I feel we need to consider are ways to reach out to those communities, that our outreach efforts in this period prior to elections and prior to the completion of the bylaw revisions is extremely important, because through that outreach effort, we activate many of the thousands and thousands of people from those various constituent groups that I believe are already listening, but not necessarily heavily involved. We also have an opportunity then to have the feedback and input from those communities and those constituent groups play more of a role in the formulation of the final plan, so to speak, final product, if you will.
Well, we're also joined here in the studio by another longtime listener activist who played an important role in the campaign to take back Pacifica, and that's Sheila Hamanaka, who is a member of Concerned Friends of WBAI, the Rockland County chapter, and she's also a Japanese American and an Asian American activist. And Sheila, tell us how you see some of the issues as Anthony laid them out concerning the related issues of designing a governance structure, a way of running this network that's inclusive of all the different population groups, and that also involves whatever outreach is necessary to achieve that.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks for joining us.
Hello, everyone. Hello, everyone in Rockland County. I hope you're listening. I agree with you, Anthony. I think it's outreach is really key. And the question of bringing in communities of color is always in the forefront, and regardless of how many people of color are on our governing boards or how many faces we see, the real issue is, are we deeply rooted in the communities? And I think Well, in Rockland, our lab rep, Gail Golden, came up with
this concept. Lab is the local advisory board.
Oh, thank
board.
You. Sorry. Gail Golden came up with the concept of radio as an organizing tool. In Rockland, as elsewhere, there are hundreds of small grassroots organizations, and people are busy doing things every day, fighting local battles, whether it's over housing or transportation or racism in the schools, etc. And BAI does sort of touch and skirt upon the issues of things that are going on in the city, but it tends to be dominated by people who live in Manhattan and Brooklyn, I hate to say it, because they can get here the easiest. They just hop on the train and they're here. It's kind of a trek for people to come in from the outlying areas, which may represent another 10 million people, perhaps, outside the city. But I think that people definitely will respond to the station if the station responds to them, if they feel like they have a voice. They're not just listeners, but also talkers, that they have an open door. They, you know, you hear this all the time on BAI, the door is open. Well, let the door be open not just for people to come in and answer phones and drop off contributions, but also to get on the air, which means implementing changes in programming, which some producers, not Bob obviously, may be resistant to. But I think if we really use the radio in the fullest sense, that we will get a good response from the people.
I also have a question. As I've been listening, I have been involved in some of these politics, but not as closely as either of the three of you. And I understand the importance of being inclusive and bringing in as many people as possible. But it seems to me that that's really a focus on community-based, on programming. But is that really what the bylaws are? I'm not clear yet what this has to do with the bylaws.
Well, let me throw that question to Anthony, because what Kathy is addressing is the issue of programming ultimately is decided by somebody. In the current scheme, that somebody is the program director working with the advice of a program council, which currently is made up of other staff members, other producers on the station who sit together and consider what might be good new programs or advise the program director on how to evaluate existing programs. The program council and the local board have just agreed on expanding that council to include one member of the local board, so that would mean one listener. But all of this is up for grabs in the new system that is now being hashed out in these public meetings. So, and there the question of who's sitting at the table when things are hashed out. Are there representatives of poor communities, of Black, Latino, Asian, Native American, prisoners, lesbian, gay, disabled? Is their voice really heard? Anthony, how do you see those issues being tied into the bylaws questions?
Wow.
I know, that's a big question.
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. Thank you, Cassie and Bob. In that, on the one hand, as a listener radio station and network, we are only what our listeners enable us to be through their involvement and through their funds. However, we program in one way or another through the structures that are created, be they individual producers programming or a program council who's composed of representation from some segments. Formally, to have representation from the listener community is critical if the voice of what listeners want is to be incorporated officially in the process of making decisions about programming. But as Bob, you know, correctly identified, even within the listener community, there may be a certain narrowing. And so to have the broadest kind of representation of the constituent groups, you really have to structure that in. You have to do it in two ways, by stating a priori that the input of communities of color and a variety of other constituent groups, some of those that I've mentioned, are to be represented in those who come together to participate as a program council, as your local board, as your national board. But in addition to that, there are things that we've learned with respect to the struggle that we were already engaged in, and that is that by actually going into a variety of settings within communities, geographically, strategically situated locales, where participants from this community or that feel very comfortable and are likely to participate. We can do both a public meeting forum kind of situation and also do good radio at the same time. Some of the WBIX radio and exile functions, not the least of which is the last one, show that we can do both things. So on that level, that's critical. I want to say just one other thing very quickly to this point. In addition to this, it's very important that those who represent the listener community that presently exists try to think outside of the box, to use what has already become a cliche thing. Most of the listener community that's active on a day-to-day level do not constitute in the same proportions, I suspect, the population of listeners to the station that are out there. For instance, there are not nearly as many people from the African ancestry and Latino and Asian communities, for instance, involved in some of the day-to-day activist work, as I suspect there might be, so that those people who are involved, primarily, most of them are white, need to really look very critically at whether or not the work that we are doing in the way of outreach is yet sufficient. And I think that that's part of the challenge that translates back into programming as well as into overall issues of governance.
Sheila Hamanaka, listener activist from Rockland County.
I would agree, Anthony. Again, there's no way to separate programming from elections. I mean, Pacifica is the air. That's what it is. And if you don't hear your voice on the air, you're always listening to somebody else talking about you. Let's say Asian programming, for example. There is right now 1 hour a week of Asian programming.
Actually, two. There's also Wednesday afternoon behind the news with Deepa Fernandez and Bijou Matthews.
Thank you.
You're
thank
right.
You,
it's small.
However, if you take the 24 hours a day, they're really, I mean, just in terms of numbers, should be over two hours a day of quote-unquote Asian programming. Not that I believe in this kind of segregated programming that does tend to exist on WBAI, where you have your Jewish show, your Arab show, your Asian show, et cetera. The whole issue of racism that exists in society also exists here in the station. And these are things that need to be dealt with by everybody as a group. And this whole debate about racism has been coming up on our list of arguments about, you know, how are we going to get more Asian voters? How are we going to get more Latino listeners, et cetera, et cetera? Whose job is it to go reach out to these people? But again, if the station is open in terms of programming, people will come in and get involved.
But Sheila, aside from the very important point you're making about changing the nature of programming and whose voices are on the air, how can these concerns be designed into the governance structure, the way that decisions are made, who has the right to vote in the elections for the local board, how is the local board constituted, what are your suggestions along those lines?
That's another big debate, whether there should be affirmative action, whether there should be mandates. I believe there should. I think we have a progressive group, but it does tend to be dominated by almost professional. Well, I shouldn't use that term. People who are very involved in politics and have been for a lifetime, and may be predominantly of European ancestry. So regardless of their good intentions, they can't speak for the Asian community. So I think in terms of who's on the lab, who's on the national board, et cetera, it has to be clear there must be a certain percentage of people of color, of women, people. There must be people who are disabled. There must be children's advocates on the boards. They must be there.
I think this is important too, but we can't overlook that the last National Pacifica Board had a lot of African American folks on it, and they weren't one bit of help. In fact, they were an adversary to the principles of Pacifica. So I think that there is a danger when we start looking at we have to have a certain category of race or gender. And instead of it seems to me that the bylaws in some way have to illustrate certain principles. and then we can sort of work out the other issues, but the principles are the most important
ones.
Yes,
I agree with you. I think that people, you know, not just any old person, any old Asian person should get on the board. Because plenty of Asian businessmen in New York would love to be on the board of this, you know, 50,000 watt station, blah, blah, blah. But, again, if the station's job is clear, if it says this is our mission, we must go out, work with the community, we must get those people on board and part, so that they're so integrated into the system that you can't pull them out any more than you can pull my arm out without a struggle.
Right.
Let me throw it last word to Anthony McCall, since we are running out of time, which is to how you would respond to Kathy's question, because to me the issue is not to choose either a racial or some other category of people for the board versus a political one, but how to, pardon the expression, marry the two considerations to make sure we want the entire board to be progressive people committed to the original mission and the updated mission, the multicultural mission of Pacifica, but also to represent that rainbow. So, Anthony, what would be your concluding remarks on that question?
Well, again, I want to thank you, Bob, for significantly putting an answer to that question. I would say that it is very important that politically we understand, as a core of active listeners and a broader core of participating voting listeners, that Pacifica is a political station. That is an extremely important part, that we represent those groups, communities that are under attack, and those who are willing to join forces to defend those groups and to try to change this world. On the other hand, once that is established, that aspect of the political, we feel, because of the significant structural problems of racism, et cetera, that you actually have to have, as another part of the political awareness, communities of color and other groups that are underrepresented in it. So it's not an either or, as you point out, but a both and.
Okay,
that is really important.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank our guests, Anthony McCall from the Local Advisory Board and Sheila Hamanaka from Concerned Friends at WPAI. This dialogue will continue, and in a couple minutes we'll play an announcement of the next meeting, which is tonight, of the bylaws committee that's open to the public, and another one will occur next Tuesday evening. So stay tuned for these announcements of how you can get involved in the debate. Kathy.
And I just wanted to remind those of you that the Borough of Manhattan Community College is having a free day of healing and stress relief for the students of the college, May 1st from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and May 2nd from 12 noon till 8 p.m. For information, contact Professor Chapman, area code 212-220-1334. That's 212-220-1334. They're also looking for people to contribute services and to help along the day. So if you can take your healing work, massage, or whatever down to that school, please call the number 212-220-1334. You're listening to Cyber Tribe, the piece Voices from the CD Spiritual High. Earlier we heard Soul to Soul, Our Time Has Come, from the Volume 2, New Decade, 1990. And our opening piece is from Incendio, the CD Illumination.
That was Incendio Illumination. I really like that one. I think it's very appropriate as you start your program, Health Action, each and every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Do we have a website that people could log on to find out more information about these issues, Bob or Kathy?
Yes, thank you, Michael G. Haskins. The best website to get all the background on the bylaws discussion is WBAI.net. Not to be confused with the station's own site, WBAI.org, which is also an interesting site. But on bylaws, just look for the icon on bylaws revision on WBAI.net.
All right. Thank you very much, Bob. Thank you, Kathy. Coming up in a moment, we'll be Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton. Just about out of time, as a matter of fact. We are out of time. couple of announcements and then talk back with Hugh Hamilton. This is WBAI in
in shaping the new Pacifica. The bylaws meetings continue, this time in Maplewood, New Jersey. On Tuesday, April 30th at 6:30 p.m., we'll meet on Baker Street at the Maplewood Memorial Library. New Yorkers can take the Midtown Direct train from Penn Station to Maplewood. The library is just a block and a half from the train station. So join listeners from around the tri-state area Tuesday evening, April